Pierre Boulez's Dérive d'Heure here at the Royal Albert Hall. Daniel Barenboim conducted 11 players for the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. And he goes round each of the players now, shaking their hand, including that of his son, Michael Barenboim, the violinist and leader of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. You know, there's a connection between that music and Beethoven's music. Boulez himself has said how Beethoven is a model creator of slow music that embraces a lot of rapid activity, as Paul Griffiths puts it in his programme note. Just one of the programme notes you can see at bbc.co.uk/proms. And a really close connection between Daniel Barenboim and Pierre Boulez. You know, watching Barenboim conduct that music, his conducting technique, he doesn't use a baton when he was conducting that chamber scale music, he does when he's conducting Beethoven's symphonies. He looks very similar to the way Pierre Boulez conducts his music, those explosive movements of his hand that somehow command all of the complexity of that music and its expression too, a real ecstatic effulgence at the end of that performance. The 11 players, headed by Michael Barenboim, come on stage here again at the Royal Albert Hall to accept this warm applause from a really full Royal Albert Hall. In fact, Barenboim appeared as a soloist with Pierre Boulez conducting here at the Proms, his second Proms appearance in 1966, playing Beethoven's fourth piano concerto. That tidbit of information, like details of every concert that has ever been played at the BBC Proms and the Proms before it was the BBC Proms, available also on the Proms website. And that the first of five pieces by Pierre Boulez that the West Eastern Divan Orchestra will be playing between now and next Friday, and that climactic performance of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Well, it's interval time here at the Royal Albert Hall, and a chance to hear from Daniel Barenboim himself. In a Proms Plus event recorded just before the doors opened for tonight's concert, he spoke to BBC Radio 3 controller and Proms director, Roger Wright.
Let's talk about Beethoven. So when did you first encounter the music of Beethoven?
Well, I encountered his name before I encountered his music, because my parents and I lived in the same flat with my grandparents. And my grandmother, maternal side, was not particularly fond of the fact that my father had become a musician, or rather that her daughter had married a musician. And then that even her daughter started teaching music, piano, and really specialized herself in teaching children and did a wonderful job at that. And when her grandson was born, that he also, that was too much for her. And for some reason, which I never understood, and unfortunately I never had the courage to ask her, she hated Beethoven. And whenever I would play something, and she would say, "What was that?" And I would say, "Mozart." And then for some reason, once I played Beethoven, I said, "What was that?" I said, "Beethoven." "Fui!" That was the reaction. I've always sort of, you know, it's such a stupid, childish thing I'm recollecting now, but it always remained for me that when there is an aversion to music in general, and I think particularly to such a strong composer as Beethoven, it is that strong. And this is when you get the sort of the more fanatic, the Wagner societies and the Elgarians. I mean, we know all of that. But
and this,
I'm one, so it doesn't matter.
And this encouraged you.
But no, I started playing Beethoven very, very young. I had played all the concertos, I don't know, by the age of 14, 15, and the complete sonatas by the age of 17. Don't ask me how, because today, knowing what it involves, not that I claim to understand them, but I know at least what is involved in playing them, I don't know how I did it. I went to school, I finished, was my last year at secondary school, and I played all the Beethoven sonatas then.
And can you remember what that music meant to you at that time?
Well, you know, in the 50s, which is when I'm talking about, there were two sort of rather independent school of thoughts as far as piano playing was concerned, and I suppose in music too, but piano having such a large repertoire was clear. You either had a classical education and became a sort of very small version of Schnabel, who played a little bit of Bach, a lot of Mozart, some Haydn, Schubert, but Beethoven above all, and Brahms. Or you belong to the virtuoso school, like Horowitz, and you played Chopin, Liszt, Rachmaninoff, etc. I had a very classical education from my father, who was my teacher, and the modern. In other words, I played all the sort of so-called serious music, and then I played three or four different Prokofiev sonatas. I played Bartok, I played Stravinsky sonata, all that as a child, really, because that was the contemporary music then. Stravinsky, who was still alive, Bartok, who had died in 1945, and Prokofiev, who died in 1953. The Second Viennese School was not really played in so-called normal concerts. Those works were left for the specialized Darmstadt and Donaueschingen places, and I suppose the Proms, since Henry Wood conducted Schoenberg Opus 16 here in 1912. I was amazed when I first heard that. And that Sir John Barbirolli played the cello part in the first performance in England of the Schoenberg Kammer Symphony in 1925 at the Wigmore Hall. Amazing. But I mean, the Second Viennese School was not really sort of deemed fit for general consumption.
and so was Beethoven then at that time just part of the piano?
Beethoven was the center of all of that. Was the center of all of that.
And so the sonatas already for you were part of a central piano repertoire. And
yes.
Was that your way in then to Beethoven?
Oh, definitely.
Through the piano?
Definitely. Definitely. The piano sonatas and then the concertos, the chamber music, then the symphonies, and then Fidelio, and then the Missa.
And so, as a conductor, having had that experience as a pianist, how unlike the experience of coming to it as a pianist is the business then of conducting the symphonic repertoire for the first time? Is it all part of the same world for you?
Yes and no. Yes, of course. Yes, of course it's the same world. It's the same type of music. No, because in the end, although people speak so often of the power of the conductor, in the end, I said to the orchestra today, there was one place we couldn't sort of do it exactly as we wanted. I said, well, you know, in the end, I'm totally dependent on your willingness and ability to do it in such a way. When I play the piano, I depend only on myself. But of course, it was extremely useful for me to come to the symphonies after having had such a long experience for so many years with every other kind of Beethoven composition.
And where did your conducting of Beethoven start? With which symphony and with which orchestra?
Number 4 I conducted in the class in Salzburg in 1955, and then 8. And then I think it must have been my first so-called professional engagement. I say so-called because I'm not sure I was such a professional. It was the Second Symphony in Haifa, in the North Israel. And the first time I conducted the Ninth Symphony was in Manchester. And it was Bob Rowley, who I felt very close to, and I played with him a lot. And he said to me, he said, "Have you ever conducted the Ninth Beethoven?" and I said, "No." He said, "Well, you should." And anyway, he not only pushed me into it, but he gave me access, which I suppose today is much easier to get to than then. I'm talking about 1969. He gave me access to the Wagner changes of instrumentation in the Ninth Symphony. And then I conducted it in Manchester.
It's fascinating to hear you talk of your good friend and musical partner, Sir John Bob Rowley, in connection to Beethoven.
Yeah.
Because I think, obviously, in the UK, we might think of him with other sorts of repertoire. And probably thinking of your Beethoven tradition, in addition to Bob Rowley, then
Klemperer,
Furtwängler. So do you feel, then, in a particular line of Beethoven performance tradition?
I don't know. I don't know. Let me evade a direct answer.
I might try again later.
When I think of the piano sonatas, how I really got to know them and what was the way for me, even after I had learned them and played them, to continue growing them, were, of course, the different editions of the great pianists. You know, the Urtext editions were just beginning to come out. In the 60s, I think, the Henley edition came out. But I had the Schnabel edition of the Complete Piano Sonatas. I had Eugen Dalbert. I had some sonatas, not all, of Bülow, a lot of that. And that's really what I grew up. And at that time, I thought that all of them were part of one tradition, of one way of seeing and of playing the music, which of course is not true. It's like with the conductors also, you know, especially with conductors who conducted the same orchestra one after another, and then you feel it was the same music making, and it wasn't. I remember in the 60s when Karajan had already been about 13 or 14 years with the Berlin Philharmonic, and out in Berlin or in Vienna, they talked about the differences between Karajan and Furtwängler. But outside in London, and I think it was the same thing. It was the Berlin Philharmonic and this same line, you know, and I think both Furtwängler and Karajan both would have been horrified at being mentioned in the same sentence. No, really, you know. And so it depends very much how you look at this. I mean, I was always extremely interested in the way of reading between the lines of all these pianists that I had mentioned now, and also Edwin Fischer, whom I had the great privilege to get to know as a boy. And with the conductors, I heard Furtwängler conduct only one symphonic program, and that was the Eighth Symphony, the Große Fuge, and the Seventh Symphony. And I was, of course, bowled over, but I cannot claim that I knew why. I was 11 years old.
But Clem,
I liked all this. So later I understood what it meant.
but But Klemperer you saw.
Klemperer, I played all the Beethoven concertos with, and I recorded them all with him. Klemperer was, Klemperer belonged to no line, to no tradition. He was really by himself, as actually was Furtwängler too. I think Furtwängler probably belonged a little bit to the line before that. But Klemperer, you know, Klemperer was, by the time I played with him for the first time in 1967, must have been early 67, he was already of a certain age. I don't remember exactly when he was born, but he was already of a certain age, and he had had his stroke, and he had burned himself, and all this. He was not exactly a picture of health, and he had great difficulty moving. But this monster, he was 2 meters high when he stood up. And he would sit on the chair, and he could hardly move that, and somehow the arms would come up, and then they come down, and there was a sound that I had never heard before nor since, granite. It was like stone, like solid, very sculptured stone. I can't describe it another way. Klemperer had no interest whatsoever in beauty of sound or this, all these things. It was basically this kind of very, very sculptured sound and balance. And balance.
And those are things which obviously made a big impact on you. And have you simply taken those then as part, a rich part of your own musical personality? Or do
yes.
you find different
I mean,
things in
by the time I met Klemperer, which was, as I said, in 1967, I had heard, played for, and therefore met Furtwängler in 1954. So it's about 13 years earlier. And those 13 years were the years of my sort of youth, early adulthood, and I became extremely fascinated with the whole musical phenomenon, Furtwängler. The non-musical side, all the problems, whether it was had been right for him to stay in Germany or not, also interested me. But for the purpose of this conversation, the music really fascinated me, and I read every word that he had written, and he wrote quite a bit, and listened to his recordings, and I was fascinated by the fact that you could not separate the thought from the emotion in Furtwängler. Very often there was a sort of very extreme, agitated thing. You think, oh, that's so highly emotional. And then when you really look at the score, you realize that there was a very good structural sense for him to do so. Klemperer had none of that. And I talked to him a lot about Furtwängler, and he had no patience and no interest in that. He thought this was just Furtwängler's idiosyncrasies and Furtwängler's subjectivity, and that this had nothing to do with the music. Although he recognized that he was a great conductor, but this influenced me tremendously. And of course, like everything that one admires or is fascinated by, one tries to imitate. And I don't remember who it was that said that small talent imitates, great talent steals. Because the talent is so great that once he has stolen it, it has become his. And so I came from all this thing for Furtwängler, and I started to try to do the same thing very often and to try and imagine what he would have thought. You know, and I was very proud of the fact that not one day passed in my musical life where in some way I was not thinking of him or what he would do with this phrase or with this transition, because Furtwängler's originality of thought had to do with the fact that he made a very clear difference between music that starts with a sense of being here and others that become with a sense of becoming. Furtwängler was about to and fro and about the transitions. I don't think Klemperer was so interested. I may be doing him an injustice, but I don't think he was so interested in transitions. He had a statement, the statement was finished, he turned a page, and then came the next statement. There was something extraordinarily matter of fact, but in fact, it was the fact of the matter, not the matter of fact. It's not just a silly play of words I'm doing. It was really that. And I must say that my encounter with Klemperer brought me to revise so many things and wonder whether I could not achieve a synthesis between these two great mountains, Furtwängler and Klemperer. And now I'm coming to what you really wanted to hear, the answer. And I have conducted the symphony, Beethoven symphonies, I don't know how many times. It also makes no difference. But these are works, of course, that have accompanied me all my life. I still believe that I learned to think the music in Furtwänglerian terms, but without in any way, without in any way being critical of him or thinking I know better. I don't mean that way at all. I've tried in the last 5 to 10 years to see whether a lot of the abrupt changes and transitional changes that he did so inimitably, wonderfully, could not be done just with the change of color, with the change of balance, with more emphasis on the harmonic changes rather than on with extreme changes of tempo. So I'm in no way claiming that I think I do the symphonies now better than I did. And by this, I don't mean, of course, to say that I did it so well before that there was no room for improvement. But I don't mean that at all. But I'm sharing with you a little bit my thought process. And I think that the musicians in the orchestra today have the technical capacity, and in this orchestra, the musical ability to think that one can make this experiment. My God, that was a long answer. I'm sorry.
Maestro Daniel Barenboim, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Daniel Barenboim talking to Proms director and controller of BBC Radio 3, Roger Wright, in that Proms Plus event recorded at the Royal College of Music just over the road here from the Royal Albert Hall just before the doors opened for tonight's prom. Details of all the Proms Plus events on the Proms website, where you'll also find the Proms blog and daily 3-minute Proms music guides, in addition to everything you could hope to want to discover about each prom every day. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom, the first concert in Daniel Barenboim's complete cycle of all 9 Beethoven symphonies. Now, of course, this is a hugely exciting prospect, playing all of these symphonies in a relatively short space of time, just a week or so, but it's also a massive challenge for the conductor and the players. The West Eastern Divan Orchestra cellist Nasib Al-Ahmadi and Lenore Katz from Israel told me about the special relationship between this orchestra and this composer, Beethoven.
We worked a lot, so I feel like we're very ready by now to perform these marvelous pieces. And I feel that playing the whole cycle is so powerful and brings the best out of the orchestra so far. We played lots of repertoire before, but there is something about playing the complete cycle that is even more powerful.
Is it possible to say what that special thing is? Is it a combination of the music and the scale?
I mean, the
of
music
thing?
Of Beethoven is very powerful in itself, and it's very classical in a sense that the orchestra has to be really disciplined. The other thing is that repeating these pieces for over, now the orchestra exists for 13 years, and we always had one of the Beethoven symphonies on tour with other programs. So this is getting like part of the orchestra. The sound of the orchestra is around the Beethoven cycle, kind of.
Does it mean something special to you then as a group coming to these pieces? I'm thinking also the recordings you released of the cycle earlier this year, Beethoven for All. I mean, there is a message going along here about what Beethoven's music means, not just for this orchestra as a symbol of cultures coming together, but even for the world. Do you feel that when you play?
Well, I feel that each symphony symbolizes something different in Beethoven's mind or ideas, and maybe this is a symbol for what each of us feels and the different people in the orchestra.
Beethoven is probably the most popular composer of all times, you know, and it's not for no reason. His music is universal, and everybody on earth is playing Beethoven and enjoying Beethoven, which cannot be said about all composers and all music. And playing them for us in this situation, in our orchestra, with the backgrounds of our political and cultural differences, it's even more meaningful, I think.
Naseeb Al-Ahmadi from Lebanon and Lenore Katz from Israel, two cellists of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. Right, and so to Beethoven's Second Symphony. Now consider this. At the time, at its first performance in 1802, this was the longest, grandest, and loudest symphony ever written in musical history. But it's a piece whose energy, self-confidence, and sense of abandon were composed at a time of major turmoil for Beethoven. He despaired at his prospects for the future because he was aware, for the first time really, of what was happening to his hearing, and he set down his near-suicidal feelings in a so-called Heiligenstadt Testament, a letter he wrote but didn't send to his brothers. And yet the symphony's boldness belies any sense of self-pity or resignation. There's the scale of the slow introduction we hear first, the concentration of the tunes and the way they're worked in the opening allegro, the emotional range, the huge emotional range of the slow movement, the ferocity of the scherzo's third movement, so called for the first time in symphonic history, and the wildness of the finale. The whole thing is irresistible in the momentum it creates. This is a piece, just like the First Symphony, which matters on its own terms more than what it prefigures for the rest of Beethoven's symphonies. And yet, if you know those later pieces well, you'll be able to hear clues. There are even tremors that seem to look forward in time to the Ninth Symphony in what you hear in the Second, the way that B-flat major and D major are put against one another, right almost from the very start. Beethoven does a very similar thing in the Ninth Symphony. And actually, there's a wonderful thing, thinking back to the First Symphony that we heard in the first half. When that piece was first performed, it would have appeared on the program not as Symphony No. 1 by Ludwig van Beethoven, but as Symphony in C. These pieces are pieces of new music. Certainly, that's what Daniel Barenboim believes. He comes on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall now to lead the West Eastern Divan Orchestra in Beethoven's Second Symphony in D major.